deixa nele, ele foi na babagem.
30 amperes. Hello and welcome to Catalyst and Witness, the podcast devoted to personal explorations at the New York Film Festival. I'm your host, as always, Ryan Swen, and this is the first festival dispatch for the 2021 New York Film Festival. And as you might know, the festival is completely in person, all in person this year, and so I am not able to cover this edition like I was able to last year. But I'm pleased as ever to have on a roundtable of far-flung correspondents, all in New York currently, starting with...
Forrest Cardaminas. I'm covering the festival for Reverse Shot and doing interviews for Assorted Outlets.
Hey, I'm Soham Gadre. I'm covering the festival for the Film Stage and Film Inquiry.
Hi, I'm Susanna Gruder. I'm covering the festival for Reverse Shot.
Hi, I'm Patrick Preziosi. I'm covering the festival for Interview Online and Ultra Dogma.
Great, thank you so much to everyone for joining me. So, of course, this is now that the festival is back in person, things will be a little bit more on the move, and people are as busy as ever, or even busier than last year, presumably. So people will have to sort of duck out at various points. Forrest is very close to the scene. He's not quite on Film and Lincoln Center, or at Lincoln Center right now, but you may hear.
You could see the fountain, if not for the... Track and oh,
I can see that. Things will be a little bit more, or a little bit less controlled than last year, but there are a lot of films to discuss. But before we do so, it's now that the festival is back in person, it means that there is a great demand, a great need for workers, and this is obviously this is a part of the festival, but. We all believe here that they should be fairly compensated and that they should be represented and have their demands and voices heard. So the Film and Lincoln Center Union formed, I believe, last year, and has been trying to negotiate with Film and Lincoln Center's board to be able to get these demands heard. And so they've been leafleting outside of New York Film Festival for during the week that the festival has been running so far, and I reached out to them to for a statement, and Dan Sullivan provided this statement for me. So this is from Film at Lincoln Center Union. The New York Film Festival continues at Film at Lincoln Center through October 10th. As FLC's marquee annual festival, it requires all hands on deck for 17 days of screenings. Last year, FLC's theater staff and full-time administrative staff formed the FLC Union, which has been negotiating with FLC management for over 6 months now in the hopes of obtaining a fair first contract for our workers. Some of us currently make as little as $15.50 an hour with no benefits, and the median salary for all full-time staffers within the union is $58,250. FLC spends nearly twice as much on compensation for a handful of its highest paid executives as it spends on the salaries of the entire full-time unionized staff. In a city such as New York, it's clear that without a fair contract, our workers cannot make ends meet. Furthermore, FLC has rejected our proposal to provide healthcare coverage to our theater staff, who have been at the front lines of FLC's return to in-theater screenings during the pandemic. our theater staff deserves a living wage and benefits, particularly in light of the health risks they have been subjected to throughout this period. We hope you all have a wonderful time at this year's New York Film Festival, and we also hope that you'll support a fair contract and living wage for the workers of FLC who make the New York Film Festival happen. Follow us at FLC Union on Twitter and Instagram, and show your support on social media by tagging at FilmLink on Twitter and Instagram with the hashtags FLC Union and Fair Contract. You can also email our executive director, Leslie Kleinberg, at LKLAINBERG at filmlink.org and urge her and the rest of management to ensure fair compensation for all FLC workers. We greatly appreciate your support and we'll see you at the movies. And so I think I speak for all of us when we say that we have all solidarity to all of the FLC union members, and for them to stay safe and to be able to keep fighting and have their demands heard. So as they said that the films are still there, but we do need to keep this in mind, just in everything, basically, in all the interactions we have with the New York Film Festival. First off, how about we go around and say what you've thought of the festival so far, starting with you, Forrest.
Oh man, so I have seen the vast majority of the main slate by now, but only a handful in any sidebar, including Currents. So my impressions of the main slate are that there's a lot of good films, but I don't think anything truly great, although the two Hamaguchi films are definitely worth seeking out. Part of this, you know, it's hard to compare to last year where everything was remote, and it's hard to, the year before was just such a good year for movies that it's hard to figure out exactly where the needle should be versus where it is. But I'd say I'm having a good time, but at the same time also a little bit underwhelmed, although I'm hearing very good things about a lot of the revivals and Currents programs that I have not seen.
So, huh?
Yeah, I actually arrived at the film festival like pretty late. So, but luckily there's a lot of overlap with this festival and TIFF this year. A lot of them screened kind of the same grouping of movies. So most of the ones that I've seen that have screened at NYFF, I actually saw them at TIFF. And I guess if there's like a standout, it's the Tsuguya Diaries. For anyone who's wondering what mm-hmm. Tsuguya means, it's just August spelled backwards. That movie was a really big standout for me. I thought it was really great. It's directed by both Maureen Fazendiero and Miguel Gomez, and so that one I'm looking forward to, obviously. Memoria and Dune, which are like next week's two like gigantic up and coming screenings, and I'm also really happy that the New York Film Festival is showing a new restoration of a classic Indian film, Kumati. English title is The Boogeyman, by Govindan Aravindan. It's like a landmark movie in India's cinema history. So, and it's never had a good print. So they did a restoration of it and they're showing it here, which, that's a really big moment.
Sue?
It's so great to be back in person. I love the Walter Reed so much, and I missed it last year, and I think it's sort of bittersweet because I'm realizing how good some of the movies from last year would have looked on the big screen. We did what we could, and I enjoyed seeing the films at home as well, but like just being there in the theater for some of these, I appreciate them. I screened some at home like for a second time, and I'm just, the difference is staggering. So it's great to just be in the theater and have the audience around. I've had to really pare down my list this year because of my job. So I haven't had time to see as much as I usually do and sort of like let it wash over me and just be really indiscriminate. But I, you know, I've had to sort of be like, what's coming out? What do I think is going to be, you know, coming out soon, versus what do I really want to see at the festival? So I've had to be more strategic, and I've enjoyed the majority of the films that I've seen. Definitely knocked out, blown away by one in particular, The Worst Person in the World. But other than that, just there have been some disappointments, but I still have just enjoyed being here.
Patrick?
Yeah, I've only been able to see a handful of the main slate due to health reasons, and I've been in the process of moving this past week. I was nervous that things would be off to a rocky start because I was not a fan of Benedetta, but everything else I've seen, I've been quite taken by, I think, mostly including Drive My Car and The Souvenir Part 2. I haven't made it to any revivals yet, but I have a ticket to Bluebeard's Castle, the Michael Powell film, which I'm looking very forward to. Yeah.
Great. Thank you all. Yeah, I'm very glad to hear that. Like it's just nice seeing, even before the festival started, just seeing all the people actually going to press screenings again and being able to sort of experience that in person, just in person thing. So I think we'll, normally we don't necessarily talk about the gala films in these dispatches just because there's so much to get to, but I think that these gala films and just the bigger ticket films just in general have been really interesting. I want to hear what you all have to say. So we'll start actually with the opening night film, The Tragedy of Macbeth, directed by Joel Coen. Patrick, would you like to take this?
Yeah, I wrote about this film for In Review Online. I'm not the biggest fan of the Coen brothers, to the point where one of them making a film solo wasn't really that significant to me, but I was pleasantly surprised by the film. I did not mind the digital black and white that lots of people were discussing online after that 50-second teaser trailer dropped. I thought it did some really interesting things with its soundstage. It's a shot on one soundstage in Los Angeles. And just it embraced a certain artifice, which I was very happy about, this being the Coens and, you know, or being one of the Coens, and they have something of a signature penchant for violence and a certain grittiness now and again. You know, this was still, this embraced, like I said, it embraced the artificiality of its sets and whatnot. And what I liked most was, and this is a small thing, is that it seemed to be trying its best. I don't know if it completely succeeded on this front, but it seemed to be trying its best to be creating scene changes within the film as if you were watching it in a theater. There's one point where Frances McDormand, she plays Lady Macbeth, she lights a letter on fire, and she throws it out the window, and it flies up into the air, into the night sky, and the camera cranes, and it comes back down, and it's in a completely different location, but under the same sky where Brendan Gleeson's Duncan is standing. And that was just one moment in miniature where I thought that its blending of theater and film was successful, because in the press conference afterwards, that's what Joel Coen said he was aiming for.
Edo said something really interesting a couple days ago, which is that it's, cars going by, sorry, it's the Macbeth adaptation that really does the play. Like, it feels like it is a play as opposed to, for example, the Polanski or the Kurosawa, which feel like they're adapting the script into a movie. This feels like it's creating a play on film. I thought that was a really good observation. All the sets in this, the sort of very German expressionist influence, I think works very well. Macbeth to me has always been a very sort of a play that is very easy to think about in terms of character psychology, because it's sort of started by the interpretation of something that the witches say, right? Like Macbeth hears that he can become king, and that sort of is what sets him off. So in a certain sense, the entire play springs forth from an idea that's planted in somebody's head. And I think that's what German Expressionism is all about. That's Caligari in a nutshell. And I think that works very well in this. You know, I've heard it said, I don't know how true this necessarily is, so apocryphal, but I've heard it said that Joel Cohen is the one who's more interested in, like, genre when they make their films, and that Ethan is more interested in philosophy and sort of big ideas, so to speak. In which case, I think this is a really good... Macbeth is really good material for Joel to draw on, because all the philosophy is embedded in, you know, one of the great works of Western literature, and he's able to do all of his sort of genre stuff on top of that. So I think it works very well.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I was curious to see in that teaser that Patrick mentioned that it says original screenplay by Joel Cohen, or not original, but like it says screenplay like written by Joel Cohen. It's like, I'm curious how that manifests, if it does, like considering what you said about.
He does kind of similar with the soliloquies, which you can tell there's a lot of thought that goes into this, because characters will actually speak their soliloquies like they do in the play, but of course you don't want them talking in a movie just to themselves out loud. So there are other characters who overhear it, but the characters who overhear it are going to be the characters who it would make the most sense for that character to be the character giving the soliloquy to speak to, or a character who already knows the information that is being spoken aloud. That way there's no sort of dramatic shift in terms of who knows what and everything. It's very consistent with which characters are, you know, privileged to what bits of knowledge, but it allows all those lines to be spoken. I think Joel said in that Deadline interview that he cut out small parts, but for the most part he basically just keeps the play all as it is. He changes one word to make a line past tense, because the Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand are older than Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are normally played. But one of the things that really struck me is that this is a really loving adaptation of Macbeth. Like, there's a lot of reverence for the text. Yeah, and everyone brings their own accent to it, and it's fine. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, thank you. So we're moving from there to a much smaller film. From the current section is Outside Noise, directed by Ted Fence. Suzanne, would you like to take this?
Oh, sure. I watched this one at home, actually, because there was a screener and there wasn't a press screening of it that I know of, and found it really lovely and really calming and unexpected. Ted Fent is an American filmmaker, but I think he's either lived in Berlin, Vienna. He speaks German in any case, and this film is set in between Berlin and Vienna, and it follows maybe a woman in her like late 20s, early 30s, just sort of spending time with various friends, and there's really no there's no clear direction that the film is going in, and it ends without really anything really of note happening, which I think is sort of his philosophy and what he talks about wanting to make films about. Just sort of little beats in someone's life, little conversations. It definitely makes you want to go live in Europe. It's just nice to look at in a lot of ways, and I found the lead actress pretty charming, and I don't think she's really done much acting. She's an artist, and is, it, you know, just really naturalistic, and I found her refreshing. So yeah, I enjoyed this one.
Did you see his previous feature, Classical Period?
I haven't.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I'm like, it's just like, because it's interesting seeing him. I haven't seen Outside Noise yet, but I do have a fondness for Classical Period. It's sort of stuck in my mind, and it's just interesting, like, to, because that's very much about interpreting, like reading and the sort of act of interpretation. And it's interesting, like, to hear that sort of style being applied to something more deliberately quotidian, though Classical Period is also quotidian. So I'm very, very much looking forward to this. So that premiered at FID Marseille, and also, and the film that won the top prize in international competition there is also in Currents, is Haruhara-san's Recorder, directed by Sugita Kiyoshi. Soham, would you like to take this?
So this was also part of their streaming selection. So I got to kind of like watch this in my leisure. I can't say that I was particularly enthralled with this movie. I thought that the idea behind it was interesting, that, you know, the filmmaker, he wanted to create something that just sort of flowed naturally from scene to scene, following this one character around, just going through what seems like these very subtle, mundane situations in her life, conversations she has with people and meets, people around the city. But I don't know, there wasn't really like any sort of anything to grasp onto in this movie. And perhaps it's just not really this kind of like very, I don't even know if I'd call it subtlety, but this kind of just simplicity, like just pure bare bones simplicity for the sake of it, isn't something that I particularly care for all that much. I think that it's a good actually a good contrast to Hong Sang-soo, who I initially was kind of questionable about when I you know, some of his movies appeared on Mubi and I watched them, but over time I really understood that, like, he has that, you know, very kind of home movie style, where he films people in very normal situations, in very normal public spaces, but there is something to hold on to in each conversation. He kind of like laces each of their conversations with things that build over time, and this movie sort of like rejects that notion. Nothing builds, nothing really amounts to anything. It's just sort of, hey, watch this person just sort of live their life really in the purest sense. And I guess for some people, they might find that, you know, soothing and different, and kind of like a rebuke of narrative form or whatever. But I was just kind of like watching it being like, okay, what, how much time's left? And that's
Forrest and Edo, you also saw this?
Yes. I'd like to hear Edo go first, just because I've written about this film now. unless you want me to go first. I'm glad you mentioned Ozu. So this is one thing I did not write about that jumped out to me while I was watching it. There's, you know, the camera is placed pretty low to the ground, which is kind of like Ozu. But the thing that really is like Ozu to me is, in Ozu films, the things that ought to be important are not necessarily the things that are. And it is sort of like, if you look at Late Spring, the things that you do not see in that film that are just ellipsized away are things that you would think would be very important if you were sort of just hearing what the film is about and what happens, but in fact they don't even occur. And this film is like that too. The rhythm of this film is very, counterintuitive, I think, is maybe the optimal word here. Scenes where nothing happens, literally nothing happens. Like, people are just walking, not even talking to each other, or Sachi's just standing on the train, waiting to get wherever she's going. Those scenes are very long. And then scenes where people are talking to each other and seem to be, like, really in having some kind of discussion of substance will just end abruptly. Because the things that you would think are important are not the things that are important. And I think that's related to, this film is based on a Japanese tanka, which is for those who don't know, it's a short poem of, we think of it as five lines of syllables, 5, 7, 5, 7, and 7. That's not strictly speaking correct, but it's what's more important is that the tanka generally goes from depicting a scene to then having a pivot word that refers to like something that is ambiguous and has multiple meanings. It's usually written out in hiragana so that a reader will immediately grasp the multiple potential meanings of that word. And that pivots it from being about the scene that is set to the character's response to the scene, or a character's response to the scene. And the exactitude with which the director, I think, is able to emulate that characteristic of poetry in a 2-hour film, I think is really, really impressive. This is a filmmaker that is thinking really hard about what it means to create poetic cinema, or what it means to take qualities of poetry and see what they would look like in a film without just settling for easy answers. And I think that is something that is really valuable about this film. I also think that the compositions, it's basically a series of tableaux about a woman who is recovering from some unspecified tragic incident in the recent past. It's not clear if it's a breakup or maybe a suicide attempt or the suicide of a friend. All these things are kind of hinted at. It's never clear which it is. But you basically see her in a series of tableaux going through life. Her aunt and uncle check in on her. She gets a job at a coffee shop. She eats cakes with friends and different things. She takes pictures of people. But the compositions are really good. The lighting is really interesting. The way that characters will literally block one another from view in these sort of immaculately composed long shots, I think, is really interesting. This is one of my favorite films of the festival, and I think this is really you can look at this and say, talk about, you know, life goes on or some kind of revelation in quotidian daily life, but I think this is really a film about the different formal ways of expressing particular ideas, and I think it is really valuable in the way that it showcases that.
Yeah, I'm very curious. I hadn't heard of Tsukide before, so it's definitely one of the films I'm more intrigued about in the festival. So moving from that to a very different one. So this is in the main slate. This is actually one of the more surprising films, even though it's from a known director. I didn't have the chance to do the first festival dispatch as customary, and probably won't going forward, but this is definitely one of the more interesting ones, or unexpected ones. This is Todd Haynes's The Velvet Undergrounds. Patrick, would you like to take this?
It's the new Todd Haynes. I believe it's his first ever documentary, which I think is pretty significant for someone like him, because he hasn't made biopics per se, but he has he sort of made parallel universes to the cultural scenes that he's chosen to make a movie about. So like I'm Not There, which is technically about Bob Dylan, separates him into multiple characters and multiple vignettes, and I don't think Bob Dylan's name is ever said in it. And Velvet Goldmine is about glam rock, but he makes up his own figure for the sake of the film. So maybe it's unfair of me to judge what doesn't pretend to be anything more than a straightforward documentary about the Velvet Underground on the basis of those films, but coming from someone like Todd Haynes, I was a little disappointed in it. But I think the film gets off to a good start. Introduces a really interesting formal technique when it's when we first hear the voice of Lou Reed and we first hear the voice of John Cale, where just their faces will occupy the left or the right of the screen while archival footage plays on the other, on whatever the other side is. And it's kind of like, you know, the film makes it very obvious from the beginning that it is also in tribute to the whole avant-garde New York City art scene of the time. So it's already paying homage to Andy Warhol just from that. Jonas Mekas shows up pretty early on. But as the film continues and it gets more towards the Velvet Underground as a band, and a popular band and a significant band and an influential one, I can't help but think that the interview subjects just start to kind of repeat what we expect in a documentary about such a popular rock band. So you'll have people saying things like, and this is just a huge generalization, but what bothers me most about music documentaries is that you'll of course get someone saying, I had never heard anything like this before. And there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of that as the film continues, and you kind of wish that it had stayed more as a general look at New York City at the time. I think that's kind of more interesting. It pulls in such varied figures as the Monte Young, and it references John Cage a lot. I do enjoy that it rebukes the idea of the factory as a sort of, it was a debaucherous place, but as a purely debaucherous outpost for these artists. It doesn't ignore the fact that there was a ton of work being produced. I think it portrays the grind of the era quite well. But like I've been saying, I don't have that much tolerance for talking heads and documentary, especially one that starts off so exciting with its formal decisions. It feels like a deflation from what preceded when you start just getting more and more people saying the same thing over and over. Though Jonathan Richman shows up and he has a lovely interview. He has his guitar with him for some reason, but it's okay because it's Jonathan Richman and he's very enthusiastic about how he felt, he felt seen by the Velvet Underground. So he gets the pass as opposed to a lot of other people.
First thing that you also said.
I agree with basically every single word that both people have said. The only things I really have to add to this are that there are worse ways to spend time than sitting in a movie theater listening to Black Angel's Death Song or White Light, White Heat on like a great speaker system like Walter Reed's. So if anybody has an opportunity to see this in a theater, like, yeah, it's worth your time for that alone. The other thing is there are some really good demo tapes that I had as a sort of Velvet's super fan. There's some good demo tapes of early Lou Reed and John Cale stuff from pre-Velvet's. That was nice to hear. And then everything that these two have said. that's my contribution.
I mean, it's very well worth making. Yeah, I'm very very curious to see, especially just seeing those like avant-garde films like in this particular context, just seeing even excerpts from them on a more within the container of a more conventional or at least moderately conventional sort of thing. I'm very curious. moving from one film about in part about debauchery to one that is at least attempting to be very much a film of debauchery, is the Palme d'Or winner Titan, directed by Julia Ducournau. Normally we don't discuss Palme d'Or winners either, but this one seems curious for better or worse, depending on the person, depending on the viewer. So how about Susanna, would you like to take it?
Sure. So where to begin? It's Julia Ducournau's second, I don't know if it's actually her second feature, but it feels like
so,
it.
Yeah.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
After Raw, which I love, and I'm still sort of parsing out my feelings about Titan, which I think is great that it's making people have so many varied reactions. But basically, it's about a woman who is, she's a dancer. She's drawn to cars in varying ways, some more extreme than others. And she kind of just goes on a somewhat of a rampage through the first half of the film. And the second half is a very, very different, takes a very different path and goes into sort of what feels like a dream to me. And I, you know, finds herself with this Vincent Linden firefighter character, switches genders, stops speaking, and it's a really difficult film to watch if you're queasy about body stuff at all. But it was difficult to watch, and it's difficult to I watched it twice, and still difficult. But I think that it has a lot to give, and I've been thinking about it a lot. So there's some things that I think are quite cliche in the sort of just can genre, you know, just like the music drops, the barfing, which I think Eric Hines tweeted about.
Yes.
How like he hasn't seen a film that doesn't have a barfing scene in he can't remember the last time. So there's a few things that I'm not sure if they quite work, but it's really bold. It's one of the films that I was saying earlier, really has to be seen in the theater, and you know, it's a fun ride in any case. So.
And Forrest and Edo, you also saw this.
I like that phrasing on it. I think there's two movies here. One is a fairly interesting body horror type of thing, and the other is a fairly well done family melodrama. And I think both of those movies have potential, but I think they're slapped together here in a particularly unproductive way. I don't know. The more I saw this movie a while ago now, Sue and I were actually at the same screening, and at the time we talked about it, and I feel like I was more positive on it than I am now. Part of that might be all the negative voices have chimed in, and maybe that's influencing me a little bit, but at the same time I feel like it hasn't really sat well. The comment I just made about the two different movies is the one I had at the time, and I think that's still accurate. I can definitely see why Spike Lee liked this movie. It has that same sort of bombastic sort of attitude about sexuality that Spike Lee films do. But it feels very calculated in a cynical way. Like, it's a movie that at a lot of points I think does something that is supposed to make you go, wow, that's so crazy. And it sort of create this mythology around it as like a cult film or like this crazy weird movie, but in particularly inorganic ways, as opposed to something like Crash or Shivers or The Brood, which I think are probably the Brood in particular, I think, is the Cronenberg film that this has the most in common with. Those never feel calculated to me. Those feel like the work of somebody going through some shit in a way that this movie does not. This movie feels like the movie of somebody who wants to be noticed. And I think Raw was worth noticing. So I hope that next time she just makes the movie that, I don't know, of some of the without all the attention that I feel like is being paid toward reception on this film. I want that cut out of her next film. And I would like that movie more.
The more I think of it, the more I am interpreting it as like sort of a monster movie, and at the same time sort of this, the obviously the Cronenberg elements are maybe a little like obvious and overstated, but I think it's still valid to see, not to be a gender essentialist, but to see a film about women's bodies made by a woman that is trying to get noticed and is about women who are trying to get noticed, or at least in the beginning. And it's like with Raw, and I feel like this film sort of just takes the frustration and the physical intensity of Raw and just turns it up, way up. And it's maybe too much for the film to even contain. And, you know, major props to Agathe Roussel, the lead, who, I mean, I don't think anyone could deny that she gives an incredible performance. And, you know, this is her first role, which is super cool. But I think this idea of like the violence of birth, the violence of menstruation, even this thing that happens every single month, you know, and the bloodiness of Raw, and very aware that I'm the only woman on this podcast right now, so sorry for being like period blood. No, but like I feel nothing wrong
with that.
Yeah, like I feel like that's sort of her, part of her goal here is just to, it's like a primal scream of womanhood and of like the, I think the, also just like the proximity that we are constantly experiencing to the, like the constant proximity of human bodies to machines and how that kind of gets under your skin, maybe subconsciously. And after seeing the movie, I'm constantly noticing how I interact with technology, like machines, like just being on the subway even. I'm like, I'm so close to being like annihilated right now. And I feel like that the film really gets at that kind of like primal feeling.
I'm definitely curious to see it. Like, I was mixed on Raw, but like just hearing all of the division that the film has caused is fascinating in and of itself to me. Moving on to the opening night film of The Currents is a film that's already been mentioned, The Takua Diaries, directed by Maureen Fazendiero and Miguel Gomez. So I'm going
to first, Ryan, I actually have to bow out.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for doing
it. Yes. I'll catch you guys later.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. So, Tsugawa Diaries, this is a movie, like when I first kind of like caught a glimpse about what it is about and what it's trying to do, you know, I kind of rolled my eyes in the beginning. I was like, oh, here we go. Another movie about, you know, the experience of being in COVID and enclosed and stuff. But this movie is really interesting. I really liked it. It doesn't reveal everything that it's basically trying to do, but it like kind of like feeds you bits and pieces over time, where it starts in like kind of a reverse chronological order, but it has this like very weird I guess like kind of fascinating way where it still like matches the ends of scenes and the beginnings of the next scenes in a way that sort of works even in a chronological order, even if you like flip them in reverse. And I thought that was like really interesting. And the thing that it really does the best in analyzing, I guess, like its whole experience of being a filmmaker or an artist making art during COVID and during having to be like conscious of other people is that it really understands how time works, or like it understands how time just slowly starts to get erased. And one thing that kind of like is significant is that you occasionally see these just still shots of this fruit, and in the beginning of the movie it's like it's mm-hmm. completely rotted out, and over time, like as you keep seeing these like still shots spread throughout the time of the movie, the fruit starts to get like formed back together. And it serves in at the end, like you see like this isn't a spoiler, so but at the end, like you see like the fruit actually being like placed where it is, and it's sort of like you know, showcases the way that like juxtaposed how like the characters in the movie are all kind of having to shift and change what they're doing and having to be conscious of being near each other, working in a contained area, being enclosed from sort of the rest of society in this, while, you know, the fruit just continues to deteriorate over time. Like nature is just, you know, it's not stopping for anything. It's not kind of acknowledging the situation that human beings are in. And it sort of reminded me how, like, when, you know, in the first, like, couple months of COVID, I would just, like, look out my window and just still see, like, squirrels running up trees and, like, birds, like, flying around being, like, they don't fucking notice any of this shit. Like, we're all worried. They don't give a shit. And so I thought that was, like, really interesting. And you see, like, in addition to that, what this movie also does is it blends documentary and fiction, where you're originally seeing like kind of fictionalized versions of events where you're trying to piece together wordless scenes and trying to see like, oh, what's this character's relationship to the other character? And that just like deteriorates as the movie goes backwards and you start to see the characters actually conversing their roles and repeating their lines and to each other, and different characters repeat the same line that another character had said before, and you start to see like the filmmaking process sort of in reverse, the process of creating art during COVID, the end product, and then like backwards towards how it sort of like formulates and all of the complications that come with it. And I just thought that it was really fascinating the way that it like juggled all of these different elements together.
Great. Thank you for joining.
Yeah, nice to meet you too. Nice to see everyone's face behind their Twitter accounts.
Yes.
All right, see it.
Okay, great. Sorry about that, Patrick. Continue.
No worries. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen it. I think I watched it in early July when it was at Cannes. I wasn't a huge fan either, but what I did enjoy, that the more sweeping statement that it's making on COVID was relegated mostly to its structure, and what the characters were experiencing was mostly like the maddening day-to-day of sort of navigating quarantine periods and contact with one another and people outside of their social bubble. Because I think there's a part, and like I said, I haven't seen it in a few months, where the quote-unquote star of whatever film we're watching on a day off goes to the beach, which he's not supposed to do, and he meets someone there, which he's also not supposed to do, and then a whole discussion plays out from there, and it's just within like the minutia of their day-to-day where they just have to kind of parse all this. I mean, it's not bullshit, but in that moment everyone's getting frustrated as if it is, you know. It's a very annoying thing for everyone to figure out how to move forward when someone from their crew has taken it upon themselves to leave the bubble and then come back as if nothing would happen. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that it was really, the pandemic was within the immediate world of the film.
I'm definitely curious about it. And I haven't, I hadn't heard of Fazendeiro before. She's a Gomez's partner, but she's also a documentary filmmaker. So I wasn't sure if either of you had any familiarity with her work before. Yeah, so I'm definitely curious, like, to see that. Just, I mean, that sort of melding of influences. We can go on to another sort of meta film in a certain respect, The Souvenir Part 2, directed by Joanna Hogg. Patrick, would you like to take this?
It's the sequel to The Souvenir, one of the best films of 2019.
Yeah.
I am a very big fan of the director, Joanna Hogg. She seems to make a lot of people angry in ways that I don't always understand. But this is a follow-up to The Souvenir. The Souvenir was about a semi-autobiographical film about her in film school and a relationship she had with a slightly older man who was addicted to heroin, and the film ends right around the time of his passing. And The Souvenir Part 2 picks up kind of immediately, pretty much. She's recovering at home after the death of, his name's Anthony, who's played by Tom Burke. And I loved it. It has a similar structure to all of Joanna Hogg's films, where there's no real standard for scene length or subject, yet everything still moves quite linearly, and it is still rigorously put together once you actually get deeper into it, though it may not initially seem like that because of the way she cuts between conversations and other events. This one's also interesting because it doesn't have Tom Burke's character in it, and when he is such, he presides over the entirety of the first Souvenir, and a lot of what happens in that movie is intertwined with him. Like, there's a trip to Venice that he plans for the two of them. He starts kind of changing the furniture in her apartment around her, so it grows to be more opulent and more in line with his obnoxiously sophisticated tastes. So without him, I think Hogg is even more liberated than she is in any of her films, and in her observational methods and what she decides to film and what she doesn't decide to film. This is about the making of her student film, Caprice, and about the making of Hogg's student film, but then her surrogate in the film is making that film within The Souvenir Part 2. But that's not even like, as is customary with most hog, that is kind of secondary, but everything's secondary. There's no real primary driving force, but there's a lot more conversations between family. She doesn't have just one specific romantic partner, which I think also lent a pretty, whether she liked it or not, kind of lent a somewhat generic structure to the first souvenir. We were kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop between the two of them. How is he going to be moved out of the picture? And it treats its stars in a really interesting way, because Charlie Heaton, who is in it, famous for a character on the Netflix show Stranger Things, I think only has a combined few minutes of screen time, which I just, that is a, I don't know, for me that's a significant choice for someone making a film in 2020-2021 for A24 that also has Tilda Swinton and her daughter in it. And Harris Dickerson's great, he's in it too. One, this is, and Richard Ayoade is hilarious as a director who kind of shows up every now and then. One thing I was kind of thinking throughout, though, is I couldn't place who Robert Pattinson was going to be. He was originally slated for this production and then dropped out. And that kind of ties back into what I was saying about the way it treats its stars, that there's no real, there's no special treatment lent to anyone. So I couldn't figure out where someone as universally recognizable as Robert Pattinson would fit in.
Yeah, like obviously it's in the credits that for Souvenir that the Souvenir Part 2 is coming soon. But it's interesting to like to think of. I haven't seen it, of course, but like it's interesting just to think of it because those last two shots of the first Souvenir are just so like they're like designed and they do and have this sort of monumentality about them, especially the second to last one, which is of her filming. So like it's curious, it's interesting to hear just how it sort of, would you say that it sort of elaborates on the aims of those last?
Actually, she kind of walks back from that, and I think this is an intentional decision. And what I think is a pretty brave part of the film is that I think she's kind of admitting to not having the artistic maturity to pull off what her character is attempting film-wise in the first Souvenir and what she's attempting film-wise in Souvenir Part 2. And yeah, because it, you know, she has, there's a lot more on-set drama in the Souvenir Part 2. You know, her cast has trouble. The film is basically about her and Anthony in the months leading up to his death. And it's such an intensely personal film to her, obviously, and because it's so personal, it doesn't translate to her actors and to her crew. And that becomes very obvious through her kind of indecisiveness of how to fairly treat her memory and how to fairly treat her memory and how to also make a movie. And you don't get this sense that she knows what she's doing until really the finish of the film, where she's working on a music video, which is a lot different, I think, from the first film, because she's walking out of just completing one of her student films. Mm-hmm. And her working on the music video in the end of Part 2, I just think, is also an interesting choice. This sort of admittance that she found something of an artistic voice by doing work for other people, which Amy Talbot didn't seem to appreciate.
I'm definitely curious about it. Like, the Hog has gotten better from each time, or with every film, so I'm very curious to see it. To close, I think we'll go on to our last film for this part. Obviously, there's many other films, including some that I've actually seen, like Zhu Shengzhe's River Runs, Turns, Erases, Replaces, and Kira Russo's El Gran Movimiento that I've actually seen. I don't think we'll have the time to talk about it in these dispatches, but I mean, those two are our lovely films. But for the final film, I think we'll turn to another main slate film, The Worst Person in the World, by Joachim Trier. Susanna, would you like this? I know you've already written an excellent review of it for Reverse Shot, but if you'd like to say some things about it.
Yeah, I could talk about this movie forever. Actually, I guess I've written about it, but I haven't really talked about it. But I love this movie, and basically, like, there's no other way to describe it other than saying, I mean, it just, like, got stuck in my head. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I was listening to the soundtrack on repeat for days. Also, just trying to get, like, in the headspace to write about it. But, like, it's the kind of... It's almost like a music video. I think Trier said he kind of wanted to make a music video. And he also was kind of inspired by, like, big movie musicals. Also, the tradition of romantic comedies, George Cukor sort of specifically, and this, their ability to say much more than what's on the surface, about life, and to tell a story about what it means to be a person through the framework of a romantic comedy, which is just such a wonderful, presentation for any film. I mean, it's delectable. You just want to, like, eat it up. But then you're, at the same time, it's like a candy that has, it's like a vitamin, like a gummy bite, let's say. It's like, it's like really good for you in a lot of ways, but also really fun to take in. It follows a woman in her late 20s, early 30s again, just sort of finding herself. She goes through a few career changes. She goes through a few different love interests, and not in a frivolous way. None of the decisions that she makes are frivolous, and it kind of comes off that way in, like, some reviews I've read and some descriptions of the film, as if, like, this woman just can't make up her mind. And it's not like that. It's much... She almost is thinking too deeply about things. It's the tendency towards indecision that we all face. And Trier, it's his... I guess it's not his first female protagonist, because there was Thelma, but it's much more in the spirit of the other films in the Oslo trilogy. Sort of are not a formal title for Reprise, Oslo, August 31st, and Worst Person, but she's very much in the spirit of those protagonists, and the film really paints a loving portrait of Oslo as well, which is a city that I happen to love, and so I felt a special affinity towards this film. One of my friends, like, met a Norwegian guy and moved there, so I've been lucky enough to visit a few times, and it really is, as, like, he gets it. Obviously, I mean, he's from there, but I can, you know, confirm that it is as magical as he makes it out to be, especially the light. The light is so unique. He has a Danish DP, I think his name is Jasper Tuxen or something, and even, he said, like, even the two countries are so close, but when he came to Oslo, he was really struck by the light and how it makes the buildings kind of, they're this, like, pastel, you know, it's that like twilight. He captures that sort of twilight that's so, you know, hard to capture, but he knows exactly when it's going to happen because he grew up there. So it's beautiful visually, which just adds to it. The story is so rich and so specific in its details. that it's extremely relatable. Like, it's just a series of incidents, you know. There's a few like really important moments, but mostly it's just like these things that we all experience as human beings, you know, like feeling awkward at a party, or feeling like you're being pressured to have children, or, you know, smelling someone's body odor and liking it, or, you know, these things that are just kind of, you're like, how did he, like, you know, wherever you are in your life, there's something you can relate to. And it's not, it's, you know, there are some aspects that are specifically female, about sort of like the question of being a mother. And again, a period blood reference, quite literally in this film, but, that's very funny. But Trier and his co-writer Eskil Vogt, V-O-G-T, didn't really see it as a gendered role. They're not trying to paint some big truth about like what it means to be a woman. It's really just what it means to be a person, and they happen to like write this really dynamic female character that like, and but the her love interests are also really richly written, specifically Axel, who's played by Anders Danielsson-Lie from the other Oslo trilogy films. And he's wonderful, and he's also in Bergman Island, and I hope that he, you know, goes on to be in many more widely seen films, because he's a wonderful actor. And he and Renata Rinsve, the lead actor, are just so charming, and there's so much depth to both of their performances, while still being hilarious and light. So they go so many different places. And it's just, it's refreshing to have a film that's actually a joy to watch, that's also really provocative and stays with you in that way. That's not just like an escape, but it is at the same time. It's so many things. It's everything. It's the best movie. I love it.
Yeah, and I, if I'm not mistaken, the original title translates to something like Julie in 12 Chapters.
That's the French title. The original title is The Worst Person in the World, but France, they like Julie in 12 Chapters. But it is that's another framework that like, these chapters are, you know, pretty arbitrary, some of them. It's just a fun kind of framework. Some of them are really significant. Some of them are just like a silly episode in her life. But yeah, sort of like, here's this woman at this point in her life. Let's observe, kind of. Sorry, yeah, I'm like in the dark.
No worries. I think that's a sign for us that we probably should be wrapping up, but lightness is as good a way to do it as any. So thank you for joining me, and thank you to the listener for bearing with our sort of, we're even more on the run than usual, but I'm very happy to have these wonderful and insightful panelists with me. So we'll have another Festival Dispatch next week for the second week screenings, and I definitely hope that everyone can be here. But it's definitely a pleasure, and definitely a lot of very interesting and worthwhile films in this first week already, as you probably heard. To close, thank you all again. Solidarity once again with the FLC Union, and may they keep fighting for the right to speak, and to negotiate, and to get what is deservedly theirs. And yes, thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan.
Thank you. Thank you so much.